When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Gamers Anonymous, the podcast about board gamers and the insane fun we have at the table together. This is Chris.
Hey, this is Anthony.
And this is episode 472, top-selling board games for 2023. We'd like to thank all our Patreon backers for helping us bring you a brand new episode. Hey friends, we're back, and we're talking about the only thing that matters in the world right now, tabletop gaming. Right?
Yeah, obviously.
It's the only thing.
It's the only thing that could possibly matter. Yeah, no, it's chaos, man. It's chaos.
In the tabletop gaming industry.
Yeah, no, obviously. We're not talking about anything else.
That's the only thing that's happening right now.
Yeah.
So, yes. Because it's a thing. And it's right? It's a thing. It's still a thing.
Yeah. No, everything's fine. And then tabletop gaming is chaos. That's just what's going on in the world.
That's right. If you could focus right now your time on this podcast and about the chaos of tabletop gaming and how we will demystify it for you and talk about, of course, the top-selling board games for 2023, because a lot of people have asked, a lot of people want to know, Anthony, and we're going to bring it to them.
Right, yeah. So what games are the best? Well, not the best. The best is what we've been talking about and what we will be talking about in a few weeks. Right now is who sold the most stuff. Yes. It's money time.
Yes. We always bring the latest and greatest. This week, we're bringing the money. We're bringing the cash, dollars, bills, y'all.
Yeah.
We have a fantastic feature talking about the winners and losers of tabletop gaming as far as the financial stuff. As far as, like, the good side. You bought these things you got to play, and, you know, people are happy about it. So, yay! So, that should be fun. And we also have some big news to talk about the tabletop industry and what's happening there, because things are happening there, man.
Yeah, no, things are always changing around. I think this particular piece of news is interesting for a few reasons. It doesn't really directly relate to the games that we tend to play and talk about, but it's top of mind for pretty much everybody in the industry. And several people presented on and wrote papers about this particular topic for board game academics. So we're talking about Wizards of the Coast.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, they make a lot of money. Did you know that? But apparently they wanted to make more money. And so they brought in a new president a couple years ago when their old president, got promoted to be head of all of Hasbro.
Whoa.
Which, that shows you where we're at when the guy who makes Magic and Dungeons and Dragons is now running Hasbro. Cynthia Williams came over from Microsoft, specifically their gaming ecosystem team, and became president of Wizards of the Coast, and all sorts of things happened along the way. now, they made a lot of money, that's true. But they also made a lot of problems with their own fan base. Probably most famously when they decided they were going to revise the open gaming license and basically take it away from everybody who was using it for all of their products and undermined all of the trust that they had built with all of their customers.
Sure.
And they went back on that, but now we're at the point where people are like, nah, we don't really trust them. We're going to build our own thing, which is not where you want to be if you are Hasbro. So she's out after 2 years and they don't know who's replacing her yet.
Should I throw my hat in the ring?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm hinting at.
I see you pulling for that. Appreciate that because I could do that job because I've actually played those games and liked those games and like gamers. So I guess this is my online application for that position.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's forward it on over.
This is what I'm saying. Right. Wizards of the Coast. Do a thing and we'll do things together. That's all I'm saying, man. It's all
good. Yeah. So let's hit up Chris Cox, who's a CEO of Hasbro, and be like, hey.
I mean, Chris Cox listens. We don't have to hit him up. He's already listening right now.
Well, all of you can hit him up on our behalf.
That's right. Just let him know. Chris and me, like, he listens. He's been listening since the beginning. Right. He's a big fan.
Okay.
And we appreciate him listening, of course. And, you know, if he wants to take it to the next level, I might be available. I can't say I will, but I might be. I could be convinced. I could be convinced is what I'm saying.
I mean, I'm sure the pay is fine. So.
I mean, you know, I guess I'm doing it for the games. Let's be honest.
That's true.
I mean, it's Dungeons and Dragons 50th anniversary. That's what I'm there for. I'm not there for the money. It's not about money, man. You know, that's your thing.
Yeah, I would do it for the money. Give me the money.
Yeah. See, but the dice. Have you seen dice? Mm. You could be a dice gremlin and just collect all the dice. Like Scrooge McDuck, he just throws himself in his money bin. This would be a bin full of dice.
That'd be kind of cool.
I think I'd like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's some big changes, and they've been going through all the ups and downs and all the chaoticness. They've been rolling a lot of ones. Let's just say that. A lot of critical fails. And
Yeah. It's weird, too, because she took over... Basically, peak industry. Mm-hmm. February 2022 was like 2 years into the pandemic. The company was making more money than anything.
Yes.
And basically took over Hasbro because their president went on to run the whole company.
Yes.
Things have slowed down a little bit, which we'll get to in a minute. Like, the growth has definitely stagnated because you can't maintain infinite growth forever, ever. That's not how the world works.
How America works.
Weirdos. And so when you have these giant surges in spending that happened during COVID when people are stuck at home, guess what? That's not going to continue when people can go back outside and do things. So
it's true.
And that's what happened.
It is. But just saying, Anthony, if I was there, infinite growth.
Oh, okay. Well, as long as you're promising the one thing that they always want.
Well, I got that spell.
Oh, shoot. Yeah, see, that's the problem. Uh-huh, you don't play the game. You don't know the spell.
I guess also... Gaming just in general has exploded over the last many years. And I guess the model that everyone tends to look at is video games, especially the AAA titles. That's just not how tabletop gaming works.
Right.
We're not that. It's a lucrative and it's an amazing kind of thing, but we're not that. So.
Right. Yeah. She came for video games and that makes perfect sense when you're like infinite growth. Who makes infinite money? Video games. Never mind that the video game industry has laid off like 30,000 people in the last 12 months. But it doesn't, like you said, it doesn't work. It doesn't work for us.
On the surface, if you're not a gamer, if you're not really a gamer, you don't understand that because it just looks like games are all the same thing.
Yeah.
And then if you are a gamer, whether it's video games, tabletop games, any kind of game, then you start to understand like the nature of it. And it really is apples and oranges. It radically is. It's not the same thing. So,
and like, how do you hyper monetize something like Dungeons and Dragons where everybody can work out of the same playbook or download a PDF, you know, and how do you release 19 sets a year of Magic the Gathering without people just being like, what is happening? This is too much stuff.
Sure.
So that's where they're at right now. You're like, you can't do infinite growth when people are going to get burned out on your product.
It's true. And again, these are very, very dedicated fans. Like we talked about, you know, being a Dice Goblin, like the fact that roleplay gamers have, like, as we do, we have just endless amounts of dice, and we don't need endless amounts of dice to play the game.
No.
And we have, and you and I have endless numbers of source books, even our, you know, RPGs we've never played. I have several of those.
Many. I have like four shelves right next to me of RPGs I've never played.
Yeah. So, you know, we have nothing but love for, you know, everyone there at Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro and, you know, the outgoing president, and the incoming president. Like, just take a second. Just take a second to listen to the, you know, the podcast or listen to the gamers especially. And you can find that economic upswing if you just listen, because it's a fantastic industry with fantastic people. It just, you have to be sensitive to that. And I think that's obviously an ongoing thing that's been challenging for a lot of the studios now in the day of, like, intense social media. I mean, it's always been there, but now more than ever, where once art is released into the world and people participate with that art, they feel some level of ownership,
right,
of that. And whether it's reasonable or not, I mean, it's legitimately what happens. And I think it adds value. It certainly does add value more than loses value to it. But I don't think these industries are, or these CEOs or these boards are used to that kind of idea. That
no,
you,
no.
Yeah. So, I mean, we should probably also mention this happened last week, and I've just been spiraling about it too. Like Paramount Plus, or Paramount as far as the company, they just announced that they're canceling Lower Decks, the Star Trek show, after this season, where there was never any kind of sign of that being a thing. But Paramount is going through its own terrible downward spiral. They recently canceled Discovery, I think, last year. Strange New Worlds is coming back, but Prodigy was canceled and then sold to Netflix. So, and I think at this point, Sony might buy them. Like, everyone's talking about buying them. So, again, people do love things and have deep appreciation for it. So, I think if you spend more time with the lovers of the stuff that you produce, I think you could have insight into your business that can't be matched by any analytics or anything you're pulling up. It's there and it's available. So,
right.
Hopefully they get that ship straightened out, because there's more to come. There's more people who are going to get involved. But as you said, Anthony, there was a downslope or kind of an evening leveling out, which I think obviously people were not happy with.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I don't know. This always drives me nuts in American business and business in general. Like, you're all smart people, theoretically, right? You have all these degrees. You moved your way up in the business world. How do you not understand that market forces change, and some market forces might push your numbers up a lot, and yes, then those market forces disappear, and those numbers are going to come back down a little bit? Why do we all get upset and fire everybody? It doesn't make any sense. It's just poor planning. And I think a lot of them know that, and they're just like, well, we got to make the shareholders happy, and we'll just pretend we didn't know later. But, like, come on. It's terrible, and it creates such a challenging environment for everybody who wants to be involved in these industries to do anything, right? Whether you're a fan and you just want to see success in new products, or if you want to work in the field and you're constantly worried about them laying you off because infinite growth is impossible. It cannot happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of things with shareholders too, whatever shares you hold in whatever company you hold them in, shareholders want to see growth now. They're not interested or looking for long-term growth. They're looking for growth now so that they can turn around and sell the stock at a you know, bonus.
Right.
So, you know, when you have companies that have long histories and they're going to be sticking around forever, the company needs to look long-term. But stockholders want, what are you doing right now for us? Why aren't you making more money? Produce more magic stuff. Like,
right,
you know, try to make somehow, I don't know how you would do that, make DLC for tabletop role-playing games. Just like, okay, you want to charge everybody everything at every time? I get it. You want to make money. You have shares in a thing. But you can make money long-term at a respectable rate and such.
Without destroying all the stuff that we love.
Yeah. And again, you destroy the value of what it is that you love, because we talked about this recently, like with Warhammer, I think it was, where like people were just melting down their collections after radical changes with the systems. So show a little love, show a little consideration and concern, and you will have money coming in. Maybe not infinite growth, but you will always have money coming in, because there are no more dedicated people than us as far as like investing in, you know, as fans or as consumers. But we will have more conversations with Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro as time goes on, because they're listening. Hey guys. Hey people. Good to have
you
here
in the office. We'll see you in the office in a couple weeks.
That's right. Hit me up, interview, you know, or let's be honest, no interview needed, right?
Yeah.
No interview needed. Just send the car for me and I'll be there.
I'll send you the list of stuff that you need to pick up and it'll be fine.
That's right. Sounds good. All right. Well, that's generally what's happening out there in the world, so to speak. Anthony, there are other things happening out there in the world, not just in the fantastic tabletop industry that we know and love.
Indeed. Yeah. So question of the week this week, we're going to dive into that real quick, is I asked everybody, what is the most complex game you're comfortable recommending for people newish to gaming? So I teach a class to college freshmen where I use board games as the text and they write about them. And my understanding after teaching this class a few times now is that none of them have really played anything more complex than like a Monopoly or an Uno. I get like maybe 20% of them play Catan, and that's about it. So what games am I comfortable introducing to them when they have no experience, and how complex can I get? Like, I push that line a lot, because the more complex the game, the more interesting the decisions, the more interesting the things they have to write about. If it gets too hard, they get mad and they stop trying. And then they're just their paper is just like, games are dumb and I hate them. So define the line. So I asked everybody out there, like, what are you at? What kind of games are you comfortable sharing with the world? So over on the Patreon, where you can answer our questions and get entered into a chance to win a game of your choice from our list. We have Drew, who says, The Quacks of Quedlinburg has been a hit with both gamers and non-gamers. No hidden information, push your luck element of excitement, a funny rat tail catch-up mechanism, and a gradual layering of complexity in each round as ingredients are added. Just the right solution for experienced and new gamers. I would call out here, the no hidden information thing is huge for any level of complexity. If you're going to have people who've not played anything that heavy before, having it all open is immensely helpful for teaching purposes. Game Master Dave, good friend of the show, mentions Betrayal at House on the Hill, which kind of fun and largely scripted. Sagrada and Wingspan. Mm. Three very different experiences, but also I think could be games that'd be comfortable teaching to a lot of different people. Wingspan does have the one challenge, again, of like people have hands of cards and they may not always understand what they're looking at. But the game itself has relatively few mechanisms.
Yeah, they have that flight kit that kind of, I think everyone gets a certain type of cards.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like one is like tucking birds, one is getting additional resource. Like it kind of gives you a script for the first couple of moves.
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's huge. All right, Michael Y2 says Port Royal, the card game, has press your luck, almost no downtime, and can teach the details while playing. Very simple game, for sure. Yeah. Some hidden information, but definitely simple. Ryan says Wingspan would be a good choice. There's only four actions clearly visible on the player boards, and the card effects are all easy to follow when played or activated. So again, another vote for Wingspan. Ryan also throws in Clank. So you're either moving, buying cards, or fighting enemies. There are more effects and tokens than something like Wingspan, but it offers a fun exploration type experience instead. And then last one here on the Patreon page, we have Robert says, Azul, you can lightly strategize how you can mess with another player or just focus on your own board. Usually plays in like an hour, so if it turns out the person isn't into it, the suffering is short. And I'll add in there again, no hidden information. You can watch what other people are doing, see how they're strategizing, and respond accordingly.
Sure.
I think that's really helpful when you can see exactly what someone else is doing. If you're not quite there, if you're a little lost, but you can see what's going on across the table, that helps a lot.
Gotcha.
So a few other entries here on the Facebook page. Rodney says Ethnos. It's just a great little set collection game. draw cards, play cards. Pretty simple. Kelber says, if they were picking a game at the store, I'd probably say It's a Wonderful World or London. London's an interesting one for sure. Mm-hmm. And then if he's teaching the game, would throw in slightly more complicated games like Lost Ruins of Arnak or Apiary, just because they have great player aids and feels comfortable teaching those. Roman says Splendor, Ticket to Ride, Pandemic. It's a little bit lighter. Clara says, if I'm with them, Spirit Island. Like, sure.
Sure.
I mean, any co-op, really, if you're with them, because you can just kind of walk everybody through their turns.
But sure.
That is a lot. And Gabriel says Concordia. Scoring is a little confusing, but once that little mental hurdle is gone, the game is great. So a few other answers. Lots of good stuff in there. Some people mentioned Power Grid, Raiders of the North Sea, Viticulture, Lords of Waterdeep, Catan, Ticket to Ride again. A lot of different approaches here. And it kind of, again, the caveat of am I teaching the game or am I not is a huge one. Like, that's one of the barriers I have to deal with in class is I'm not teaching the game. I'm there to help if they get stuck, but they need to figure out the game rules and teach themselves.
Sure.
So how complex of a game am I comfortable with them kind of tackling?
Gotcha.
So like my group playing Pandemic this last week spent the first 20 minutes or so being like, what are we doing? And I had to spend a lot of time with them. But once they got it, they got it, and it was fine, because it only takes one person to get it, and then the rest of the group comes along.
Yeah. I mean, that's good and bad with the alpha gamer kind of thing, but...
Yeah. No, they had a good experience, thankfully, but I've certainly had people who had bad ones. I mean, lots of good stuff. I think I'm in the boat of something, you know, open-ended, all open information. Azul is up there for me. Pandemic, like I said, for my class is great. Cooperative games in general, I think you can get a little more complex with, and people show the frustration with that, but at the same time, everybody has open information. You can all help each other. So it definitely makes it easier, because you only need one person to really get over that line, and then they'll help the rest of the group.
Yes. I like Dinosaur Island, if you're going to ask what is the heaviest game, because Dinosaur Island is split into different phases. And those different phases are represented by the different boards at the table. So everyone does one thing, and the instructions are right on the board. Like, we're all going to get, you know, DNA dice, and everyone picks, everyone sees what everyone does. It's all out there. And then you move to the next stage. Everyone gets those dinosaur blueprints. And again, it's right there on the board. It's stage two. You do nothing else but stage two. Mm-hmm. And then three, you obviously are able to create the dinosaurs and then put them in the park. And then there's obviously picking up extra people. All of these things are laid out. All of those things are written explicitly on the boards. And the park itself is available for everybody. And the dinosaurs are nice and cute. And it's not as abstracted as, like, you have a dinosaur in a park. Like, no, you literally have a little plastic dinosaur that's in your little enclosure. And thematically, it makes sense. And I think so between the thematically kind of following and the fact that the boards and phases are laid out with the instructions, everyone's taking those turns. I would never be worried about placing that with anybody, actually, to be fair.
That's a great choice. Yeah, that's perfect. Because the game, yeah, it's designed to teach itself.
Yes. Great. Yeah, and it has like those just hard rails where it's just doing this, just this, just this, just this. You can see everything else, but you can't do anything else. This is the only thing we're doing openly as a group, and most of it is just selecting from a marketplace. There's no drafting, there's no hidden movement, there's nothing crazy there, and there's no like second, third level scaffolding of like, what do we do? Like, I want to make that dinosaur. Well, do you have the things on the dice? I do. Cool. Do the thing, dinosaur, and put it on the board. Right. Cool. That was fun. Like, yeah, I know. And again, also that game allows you to, at the very start of the game or how the game's set up, you can actually pick a short, medium, or long game. So if you just want to have a complete game, that game lets you do that. I don't think there are many games that let you determine the length of the game, so that you can kind of manage, you know, the complexity or the time-wise, as far as that's concerned.
Right, yeah. There's a lot of games that have, like, different difficulty levels, but not length.
Not length.
That's great.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you all like to hit us up on our question of the week, you can certainly hit us up on all the social medias, especially Facebook seems to be the place to be, or check out BoardGamersAnonymous.com. It's our website with all kinds of crazy and wonderful things, including all of our links and places to find us, and especially our podcast. Hit us up and let us know. All right, Anthony, so that's what everyone's saying out there. Let's talk about the games we want to talk about and definitely get to the table. Let's talk about our acquisition disorders.
All right. So I'm talking about a game this week that is designed for academic discourse to a degree in my At the Table review. And so as part of that, I was kind of just looking at other things that are out there. And there's actually one on Kickstarter right now. Now, this is actually going to end before this episode airs. So you can't necessarily back it. But what I would say is, if it sounds interesting, keep an eye on it because it has funded. They are going to produce it. The game will be out there, hopefully, in the world in a few months. And it's called We All Take From the River. So it's pitched as a game of environmental diplomacy. It's a first-time designer, Ben Hammer. So don't really have a background to know like what they're doing in game design. But they claim to have a passion in environmental policy. I'm assuming they work in that space. And the game is all about kind of working with the ecosystem of a river and all the different ways that we as humans interact with the water table, right? And whether it's taking food from the river or building near the river or adjusting things on the, like building levees or whatever it might be, like how we're interacting with that space and what ecology represents. So it's all about balance and figuring out how your actions will influence things. And everybody's going to have their own role with their own objectives, and those things are going to overlap with each other. So not only are you have to work with the river, you have to work with each other. Now, it seems like the game's doing a lot, especially for a first-time designer. So I don't know how this is going to play. And, you know, it's listing itself with, you know, kind of a full game mode and then a two-player mode and a solo mode. But I will say, you know, graphically, it looks solid. Has some interesting elements to it in terms of artwork and like card layouts. I think there's a lot of really cool stuff here. And just the idea of how we interact with the environment, how we interact with anything in the world will directly influence our own experience with it is always fascinating to me within a game because we don't always get that, right? It's like take an action, gain some points, take an action, gain some points. But how is action A going to influence action B, action C, action D, going on and on and on. So you have to manage everything. You have to deal with weather. You have to deal with the building of things. You have to deal with the wildlife. And how are you going to engage with that in a way that maintains the river and doesn't kind of overrun it? So it's on my radar. It's on Kickstarter now and hopefully get a chance to play it sometime in the future. And can talk about it a little more in depth. But it's definitely in that ballpark with the games that I'm thinking about of late. And just in terms of like games that can teach things in a way that's still fun. So that's We All Take From the River. It's on Kickstarter now, but again, probably when you're listening to this, it will have just ended. So you'll just have to bookmark and keep an eye on it.
Yeah, it already backed. So yeah. Yeah. Certainly be able people pick it up. It's at a quite a reasonable price.
Right. Yeah. You can get everything for $50. So it's mm-hmm. It's not like crazy expensive. And then they do offer educator and advocate pledges. So like if you are working for an educational institution or nonprofit, they offer an opportunity to pledge to be able to buy those games in bulk at a discount. They don't say what any of that means, but like if you're listening, you're like, oh, this could be great for my classroom. At least reach out to them and see what those options are post Kickstarter.
Sure. And then they are also pretty smart about their environmental commitments with their game. So making sure the game will last, but it's also recyclable, reusable, sustainable material. So you like to see that.
Yeah.
Nothing worse than getting a game that's like, hey, this is about the environment. And it's like, it comes with like 600 plastic miniatures that were not recycling. It's like, oh my God, I think I'm causing more damage than helping.
Yeah. I brought a game of, it was Pandemic Rising Tide. I brought to class for one of my climate change lessons. And all the students could focus on is how much plastic was in the box.
Oh my goodness gracious.
They're like, this game's about climate change. There's all this wood pieces and it's covered in paint and there's plastic and it's just like so wasteful. I'm like, uh-huh. Yeah. I guess you're right. It's not really what I'm asking you to think about, but you're not wrong at all. So, yeah.
That's, I kind of missed the mark there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm also looking at a Kickstarter called Bloom Chasers. Delightful 3D tree game with flowers and wits. It's a 30-minute light strategy game for adults. And I think also children.
Yeah, definitely for children.
I don't understand why they didn't put children there. Grow your flowers and outwit opponents on a stunning 3D tree, either as a team or competitively. So they kind of push really hardcore that there's a 3D tree here. These people have, you know, created six games previously on Kickstarter that I've backed. So I'm really surprised that they don't know that that's not a big shocking, surprising thing. But as an audio podcast goes, you should know it's a 3D tree. It's a seemingly plastic tree. I haven't read through if there's any environmental kind of thing, but it looks like a 3D printed plastic tree, better than your typical 3D print. And what's initially interesting about it is, of course, the 3D printed tree is the actual game board in which you're playing on. So a lot of us, most of us, when you play like Euro games or even Mario Thrash games, it's all about the hexes and playing on the hexes for area control and building up and developing. Well, imagine if you will, or go check out the Kickstarter, that there's a 3D printed tree where you are going to be adding branches and buds, and the buds that you're going to be adding are of your player color. And then there'll be cards being played, weather cards or a bloom card. And as you hold certain areas with your buds, when a bloom card comes around, you'll be able to, I guess, bloom different types of flowers on this tree that has different levels based upon how it's people have added different branches and blooms to it. So maybe you want to add some sort of like sunflower to it. Excellent. It comes in a certain shape and you have perfectly bloomed out your particular color. So you have a spot to put it. Awesome. You're scoring points. But there's also opportunities to utilize other people's bloom areas that they've colored on different branches. So you could kind of sneak in and snag some of their spots. So in the competitive part of the game, that's to your benefit. So each of the flowers has a different shape, which needs to be employed on top of the tree. By mid-game or end-game, you have a beautiful tree, and you're scoring a lot of points. And again, it's very much based upon these weather and bloom cards that come out and how you take actions to build up the tree on different levels. So again, the 3D element of the tree is not just the fact that it's a 3D tree, but also that the branches and blooms create all of these different levels. So when you're trying to scope out areas for your blooms to put different flowers, it becomes more and more difficult and you're able to block out or take over other people's spots. The game also has an expansion. You could add birds. Birds are awesome because they'll help you block opponents from stealing your different blooms, and they're also adorable. And there's also beehives that'll score victory points. And again, it's adorable. I mean, the game's adorable. That's why I'm telling you about the game, because it's adorable. it certainly is a very light game. Doesn't seem too complicated other than the idea of, like, since you have different planes in which you're playing your different pieces, it can be somewhat challenging to kind of, like, scope out how to make the best strategic play for yourself, but it's not overly complicated. The game itself is $30, which is pretty reasonable for a Kickstarter. $45 if you're going to add the expansion. Probably should, because it seems like a very simple game. And it's currently up on Kickstarter. So if you want to check out something that's cute and fun, please do so. And you do have a good amount of time. It's about 20 days left. Shipping is fairly inexpensive, again, depending on Kickstarter. So, yeah. Bloom Chasers, delightful 3D tree game of flowers and wits.
It's cute looking. It's interesting though. Like you say, they have six other games, but they're all like these party card games.
Yes.
So this it's a big change in direction, not lengthwise, but like you're not drawing on cards anymore. You are building a thing.
Yeah, they have a solo mode you can play as a 2v2. They have a cooperative version of this as well. Mm-hmm. It's always a little sketchy when you have a million versions of a game, but primarily adding branches, adding blooms, get lucky, put some flowers out, score some points. So I guess that could be one person or multiple people. I could see it more of as maybe it's more of a solo game. It seems like more of a solo game.
All right, I guess we'll see.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's everything we want to get to the table. Let's talk about the games that did hit the table this week. We'll let people know if those games are a buy and they should run out and pick those games up. If those games are a play and they should sit down and enjoy them. Or if those games are a dodge and they should avoid them. Or in fact, those games are the dread burn and they should burn them down because they're just not sustainable. Anthony, what'd you play this week?
All right, so I played a game that is published. It was on Kickstarter a while back, published by Central Michigan University Press, designed by Scout Bloom, called Rising Waters. Mm-hmm. It's a game based on the 1927 Mississippi flood. And it's a cooperative game in which you have to basically survive the flood, right? What makes the game interesting, though, is that it is explicitly based on a historical event, and even more explicitly based on kind of the systemic racism of the time that surrounded this event. So it's not just like, a flood happened, let's survive the flood. It's a flood happened, and the system was designed in such a way that African-American residents of the area around the Mississippi were disproportionately affected by that flood, right? So there's historical notes in the book that kind of go into the background of this, of how leading up to the early 20th century, there was a lot of policy around like building giant levees that funneled the water from the Mississippi into specific areas and made the flooding much worse, maybe protected some areas, but made other areas much more prone to flooding and much worse when it did flood. And then kind of that systemic issue that put certain people in the path of the floodwaters, and then once there were floods, treated those people much worse than others, right? So like the white residents of the area would take advantage of the situation in different ways. So that's all kind of built out and expanded on, and the game definitely reflects that a lot. It's not like subtext in any way. Like the cards all reflect part of, you know, the African-American experience at the time and represent different elements of community. And then the events that you end up having to deal with are direct things that attack and influence that community. So, you know, from things like the landowners kind of taking advantage of the workers, all the way up to things like threat cards, force cards, and even race hatred cards, like direct racism happening. And these are obviously bad things that happen to you as the players. The game itself is an interesting spin on kind of the formula that we're used to in like a cooperative experience. And the reason I say that is there are two different game modes here, right? So I'll talk about the mechanics here for a little bit. On one end, you have the 1926 version, the fall 1926, which historically was like a lighter flood, right? And this is, honestly, I see it as more like an introductory version of the game. I don't know if it's designed explicitly for like classroom play or teaching play or whatever it might be, but it was very easy. Did not feel remotely challenged throughout that. It just felt like learning the game systems. But at the same time, it left out a lot of those game systems. So there's cards that don't go into the deck. There are mechanics that are not in play at all. There's certain things you just don't do. And so the game kind of just flows and you're fine. Like, it's really just like tutorial mode, like in a video game. The 1927 version, Spring 1927, is the full game. So that's what I'll talk about. And it is significantly harder. So you have like easy mode and hard mode. There's not really a normal mode in the middle. And there's not really an easy way to kind of adjust difficulty within that scale. So like you look at a game like Pandemic and you adjust the difficulty based on how many of those epidemic cards you put in the deck. It's fairly simple. And you could even like stack the deck a little bit, which I do often for my students, to make the game a little more accessible. You're not going to lose in the first couple rounds. This has the two difficulties, which is kind of missing that middle layer. But if you're going to teach this to people, you would start with the easy mode. In terms of how the game plays, it's going to take place over 10 rounds in the full version of the game. And each round, what you're going to do is you're going to draw up a hand of community cards. These represent different elements of the communities at the time. So you have blues cards, church cards, education cards, family cards, farm cards, garden cards, and different types of resistance cards. Most of these cards don't do anything. They just give you symbols in the corner that correspond to different actions that you can upgrade. Whereas like the resistance cards often have special powers on them, like letting you ignore certain elements like the weather or a levee breaking or whatever, or dealing with like landowners and stuff like that. The display of landowner cards, there are job offers, which is the bulk of the deck, and these you're going to need to build the levees. But then there's also, again, all those bad things that I mentioned, right? You have like the landowner flees card, where the flooding is bad enough that the landowner leaves and you're left on your own. And then again, you have like the threats and the force cards. You have dynamite cards, the black or race hatred cards, relief camp cards, where people can be forced into these relief camps. There are ways to mitigate some of this, but not all of this. So a little bit of it comes down to the luck of the draw. But it ramps up a lot, right, within the harder mode of the game. And then you take your actions, and your actions involve a lot of different things. So you have little pawns on the board. They are just like your little classical, you know, sorry pawns. And you can move them around based on your movement, speed, action, whatever that might be. Your personal player board will give you the opportunity to upgrade these various actions that you have. So you start out with all of them at a base level. There is like an optional mode where you can make it a little asymmetrical, where you play for personal points and then you can upgrade one of your levels and you have like a special ability. I like the special ability element. I don't like the playing for personal points element. So I guess you can kind of pick and choose what modules you want to use here. But as you level these things up, for example, you start the game with two actions per turn. You could level that up to three or four actions, which you absolutely want to do. But part of that depends on the cards you draw, because you have to spend cards to level things up, and the cards you spend correlate to the type of action. So that was a bit of a challenge. You can improve how far you can move with a single action. You can gain a swim ability to cross the water. There's various things you can do there that help the game become more efficient. And you have to do those things. Otherwise, it's just not possible to keep up with the game as it flows. And then the game will respond with weather. So you're going to draw three weather cards after everybody's taken their actions, and that's going to add water to the river and the lakes. So there's four different locations on the map, and you're going to draw a card. It's going to have one of those locations on it, and a certain amount of rain's going to fall. There are some cloudy cards, meaning no rain, which is like a respite, but sometimes there's a lot of rain. So you're going to get between one and three raindrops. That's going to add water to the river as far down as it happens to be. I'm not going to explain the whole like water flow system because it's a little complicated, maybe a little too complicated, but generally speaking, it rains, water fills the river, you got to deal with it. The water then overflows its banks, and depending on the locations, because there are hexes all around the river, it will flood onto that space. So with your actions on your turn, you can build levees and upgrade levees to kind of block that water from overflowing its banks. But you can't block all of it. So a lot of it is like picking and choosing where you're going to do that based on what's going on in the river, current situation, how things are flowing, where your ponds happen to be, where things might be that could get flooded out, like cities and towns and people. Because every time you lose something, you move up on the lost track. If you hit a certain point in the lost track, you lose the game. So that could be losing a pawn. There are survivors you need to rescue on the map. That could be losing your own pawns, your own people on the map. It could be losing a town. It could be losing a hex area to a flood that kind of overflows its banks into that space. So it's a lot of balancing all that, like any good cooperative game. Bad things are going to happen, and you just have to kind of mitigate where they happen and how. And so in the easy version of the game, that was pretty simple to do. Like you get a fair amount of space to get those losses. Didn't really get close to the losing condition. In the harder version of the game, it was fairly difficult. There are these community goal cards that you can add to the game. that are optional, but I feel like you really should have them because they are one of the ways to reduce that loss meter. So I would recommend adding those no matter what. And it's a challenge, right? And I think it should be because the game is meant to communicate that. Now I'm going to do a written review of this because it is, the game is doing a lot. Like on here on this podcast, I really just want to kind of talk about the game as a game, but I do want to write about it as well. So it'll be on the website talking about how the game's communicating its theme and the ways in which you could inform that in a classroom setting. Because that is, again, what it's designed to do, is to engage people in a conversation about this thing that happened in Mississippi, right, with the flooding in 1927. As a game, there's some cool stuff here, right? The game is challenging. I found it interesting to kind of manipulate the water flow down the river, and choosing where to put the levees and how to adjust them and where to move my pieces. But then there's also the issue of the random draw, right? So you're randomly drawing these cards. You can mitigate that to some degree. You can draw extra, but at the beginning of the game, you don't have a lot of options. And you really want to get those extra actions, the extra movement. And if you're not drawing the garden cards, if you're not drawing the right cards to do that, it can be hard. The game becomes harder. At the same time, there's a bunch of modules. There's a bunch of options and like how to set the game up and what version you're playing. And it would be nice just to have like, here's the full game. And then here's some stuff you can add for additional difficulty. Or here's the full game, and here's some stuff to remove from less difficulty. But it's kind of like, here's two versions of the game, and then here's some more stuff you can throw in or adjust if you want to. And so it was just not 100% clear what version was going to be the best. It is a little, not long per se, but I would say some of the rules are a little more complex to get your head around. Like, the river flowing rules, once you get them, they make sense, but it's just, in a teaching setting, it would take a little bit of time to kind of get through that. Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire has a great video going through the rules to the game, and she does a great job of explaining how the water works, better than I could, I think. But as a whole, it, like, the teach was a little rough. And the rule book definitely didn't, it wasn't unclear, but it could use some additional clarity in certain areas. All in all, I thought it was an interesting experience. As a cooperative game, it's doing something different, which I appreciate. And it gives each player something interesting to do on the map. So I would give it a play. It's a unique game in a lot of ways, and not just because it's communicating about the real world issue, which I always find fascinating in a game if it could still be fun, because I think sometimes those are mutually exclusive. But there's just, you know, some rough edges around it that I wish were cleaned up a little bit, just to make the game a little more accessible. But yeah, it's a great game. Giving you something to do that is interesting, that reflects a real world experience, but then also you're fighting against racism within the context of that experience. So it's not just like performative. I think I'd like to see that more in play experiences. It's hard, I think, is one of the challenges. This is one of the bunch of games that was nominated for the Zenobia Awards a few years ago. And a lot of those games have kind of come on, and some of them are coming out now. And it's cool to see how those are being accepted and approached and reviewed and discussed, like at the table beyond like kind of the academic space. And so hopefully this one gets that chance as well, and more people get a chance to play it. So that is Rising Waters. Again, check out the written review that I'll have up here in the next week or so that kind of delves into more of the academic end of it and how it could be useful in the classroom.
That's excellent. I mean, that's what we try to do at Board Game Academics, but that's what we've been trying to do with the podcast, is get more games to the table, especially other tables, and especially allowing for education, to have that experiential education of actually playing through that kind of situation. And it can be, and clearly it can cover a lot of really important areas that oftentimes goes overlooked and now are extremely beneficial because you played a role. So I'm really glad to see that.
Yeah, yeah. And like, the thing I really like here is it's I think a lot of games oversimplify, right? They're like, oh, there's racism. look at the victims of racism. And I'm like, okay, that's good. I'm glad you're thinking of that. But like, here, there's racism and you have to fight it, but you are fighting it, right? There's agency to that. Like, the African-Americans represented in the game, they still have their community. They're still building up the community. Mm-hmm. They're still fighting through this. They're building those levees. They're trying to save their community. And when you succeed in the game, you have succeeded at doing that. It's not just like good, bad things happen. It's walking through what that's actually like to live that experience. And that's what I find so fascinating here.
Yeah, that complexity of the issue and of the interactions is always immensely challenged to put in a game. But like you said, you could certainly lose the message completely if you simplify it too much to be a game. And then you have undermined everything that you've been trying to do. And and sometimes the lesson is, it's very complicated, but you must be active in this tremendously complicated situation because your participation, your allyship, is essential for success. Even though it's not always clear, it's hard, it's clunky, it's obtuse. That's part of just life, unfortunately, in some of these issues.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, to that end, I really appreciate, like, again, I mentioned, like, the easier version of the game was a little too easy.
Mm-hmm.
But I appreciate that it exists, because
yes,
I think the game and its full version would be difficult to get into a classroom. It'd be difficult to have these conversations, because it'd be long, and it's kind of unforgiving. But you play this on an easier mode, you can still have those discussions. You're still interacting with those cards. You're still looking at the map flooding and building up and trying to overcome all these racial injustices of the time. And it's not, the game is not getting in its own way to do that.
Sure. Right?
Is it as good of a game? Not really, but that's less important, because at that point you're trying to engage with the experience. And if you want to go from there and have a more fuller experience, it's there for you. So I appreciate that they did that.
Excellent. All right. Well, Anthony and I recently were at PAX Unplugged not too long ago. It feels like it wasn't long ago, but
yeah, right.
A couple of months ago. And in our journeys around the floor, we happened to see Defenders of the Realm. Legends Never Die. This is a new, revised, refreshed, reimagined version of Defenders of the Realm from Eagle Griffin Games. Now, Defenders of the Realm from Eagle Griffin Games is and has been one of my favorite games of all time, if not my favorite game of all time, for many reasons that we've talked about on the podcast. And I'm going to mention a couple here. This new version of it, we got to see it, unfortunately did not get to play it. This is being produced by Greater Than Games, which does a great job with games. But we did get to see it, and it employs a lot more miniature plastic in the game. I think there's over 100 different miniatures in the game. And basically the game, both the original and it seemingly, because I have not played it, have not seen the rule book yet, it's going to be on Backer Kit in August. But basically the game comes down to, you are the defenders of the realm. You are defending the capital city, the monarch city, with the monarchs in it, of course, because that was the thing back then. And you are one of these adventurers that takes up one of the classic, you know, D&D classes. So you could be a fighter or a mage or a ranger or a rogue, the basic kind of class archetypes. And you're going out through the countryside to defend Monarch City versus four different terrible, monstrous forces. Now, in Defenders of the Realm, and I think also in the new retold version, they're orcs, dragons, demons, and the undead. So, four different classic D&D monstrous menaces that are coming at you. Now, they play out very similar, or almost identical, at least as far as game mechanics are concerned, to Pandemic. It utilizes the pandemic mechanisms to spread out all of these different menaces, these four different colors that are coming out to the board. And there are also generals. So there is somebody in charge of these different massive evil armies that are coming at you. And your job is to deal with all the minions, clean up all the tainted lands, and deal with the generals before the army, the generals get to Monarch City, or you run out of minions on the board, aka kind of what Pandemic is all about, or if you taint all the lands and you're out of taint crystals. So that's the kind of primarily feel for it. Thematically, it plays out like D&D on a board game. And that's lovely, right? So the basic game, you get these big, nice, chunky boards that give you a great, amazing artistic picture from Larry Elmore, who you might know from Magic the Gathering cards, and just basically everything from Dungeons and Dragons to all the RPGs, a lot of the classic artwork that we kind of attribute to old school high fantasy. The new version has different artwork. Your miles may vary, but it seems to be at least somewhat in the same realm. No pun intended. I got to get this back to the table because when I had seen that at PAX Unplugged, I'm like, hey, am I going to back this? I have practically everything for Defenders of the Realm. Do I really need this new version? And of course, since I did not get a chance to play it at PAX, I'm going to have to make that decision to back the game without having played the game. Well, since I wasn't too sure, and since we did have some people come out to the Long Island Tabletop Convention Expo, I said to Anthony, like, what game could we get to play that is going to really satisfy roleplay gamers, but also tabletop gamers? And I felt Defenders of the Realm was a great game for that because it's very streamlined, makes thematic sense, and it tells a story. And I got it to the table again, and I've been playing it out like crazy because this game has been out since 2010 and has a ton of little mini expansions and some a little bit bigger and over the years. And recently they came out with Defenders of the Realm, The Hero's Calling, which allows you to create custom heroes, and Defenders of the Realm, Companions and Catacombs, where you go in certain places and you meet certain people. I have not played those two yet. They are somewhere in my collection, and I have not found them yet. But I did check. I did buy them. I'm not sure where they are. But I'm going to talk about every other expansion super quick because, first off, Defenders of the Realm is a super buy for me. Like, this is a great old school, you know, wonderful game of D&D in tabletop format. Really great representation of all the different characters and classes and genders and backgrounds. So it's really lovely to play. And it has so many different miniature expansions that are really heavily discounted now at this point, that you can really create the type of game that you want. So these expansions, at least as far as I'm concerned, are either essential and you should absolutely pick them up as part of the game, or they would be nice to have. I haven't come across any of these mini expansions that I were like, no, this is bad, this makes the game bad, do not include this. Most of the expansions, honestly, are tweaking the game, giving you little tweaks here and there. So here's my quick little kind of overview here. Ready and breathe. Defenders of the Realm, Winds of War. This came out in 2016, and basically you are going to get 16 additional cards into the game, and basically it's going to be global effects, creating negative effects, making the game a little more challenging. It's nice to have. It's not essential for the game. Next up is Defenders of the Realm, Starling, Guardian Dragon of the Realm. This is a three-headed dragon that's actually on your side. So not all the dragons are bad. This dragon's good. You shuffle in some cards to the Darkness Spreads deck, and then every once in a while, the dragon comes out, and if you get to the dragon's location, the dragon helps you out based upon what you roll. It is super fun. Makes the game a little bit easier because there's some nice cards in there, but it's really nice to have a dragon on your side. It really adds thematic to the game, and what the dragon does is different based upon your roll and the card that comes out that time. That's absolutely essential for the game. Next up is Defenders of the Realm, the Hero Expansion number 5. We're looking at three new characters that you can play in the game. There's a bard, and the bard's pretty amazing because if another character is on your spot, the bard's giving them an extra action. There is a centaur, Elena. She's awesome because she can pick up characters and run along with them, but also hits everyone from the side. And then there's a mariner that gets bonuses from, of course, being next to the water. For all the hero expansions, I'm going to say that they're essential because the game itself, the mechanics of the monsters that come out there are fairly standard. It's really the heroes that make the day, and having the different combinations, whether you play solo or you play with a number of different people, really makes the game great. So I will say Hero Expansion number 5 is essential. I love the extra characters in here. Hero Expansion number 4 is 2 characters. There's a Dragon Hunter and a Dragon Rider. This one is not essential for me because it's very specialized for dragons. We'll talk a little bit more about the dragons in a minute. But basically, either doing more damage versus the dragons or being able to befriend them and travel with them is great. It's not essential. But again, at a certain point, maybe you're using the dragon expansion, which I will talk about in a second. Then they come into play, and then maybe they're essential for you. Next up is the Friend of the Realms, the High Council cards. This is a set of 12 cards that make the heroes a little bit, you know, give a little help. Makes the game a little bit easier. Not essential. Nice to have if you want to tweak things. Next up is the Friend of the Realms, Relics. This is all about giving the bad guys some more powers to mess with you. They get a relic, gives them some special abilities, but you could take the relic away from them. So it's nice to have if you want to make the bad guys a little tougher. Next up, Defenders of the Realm, the Noble Dwarfs. Came out in 2014. This was a standalone one kind of card expansion. You want to play as a dwarf? Yeah, you do. It's really cool, and it has some extra actions that you could play that are really nice. It's essential if you like dwarves in your RPG games. Next up is Defenders of the Realms, Realms in Flames and Darkness Spreads. This is a very small expansion, and basically it gives you cards that add really different things. Most cards in the Darkness Spreads area is all about adding minions and moving a general. This really switches those up and allows the minions and generals to do different things. I will say this is essential because, you know, you want your minions and bad guys to do different things. This allows that, and again, very inexpensive. Next up, Defenders of the Realm, Generals Expansion. Again, this is pretty cool because it adds new abilities to your bad guys in the game. So the generals have new special abilities, get to do really cool things. I would say it's essential because it comes with miniatures, so it makes the game a lot better. Next up, Defenders of the Realm, Legends Deck. This gives your hero a special bonus and a little story to go along with it. It's nice to have, not essential. Next up, Defenders of the Realm, Quest Deck. It's more quest. Not essential. Nice to have. A lot of fans' suggestions are in here. So pick it up if you want. You typically don't go through the quest deck anyway. But again, nice to have. Defenders of the Realm, Minions Expansion. This is demons, but there's also all the other ones. These are nice to have. Not essential for the game. They make the game harder. Because now the minions are not just hard to hit. But they do a lot of other things. So the demons, the dragonkind, the undead, and the orcs, all good to have to make the game harder, have new miniatures in the game, but definitely makes the game a lot harder. If you want your game harder, or if you want new miniatures, this is something to pick up. Next, Defenders of the Realm, the Errant Paladin, another single-player card, cool to have. It adds a second paladin to the game, so if you want to have two paladins, this is good to have. Not essential, but nice to have. Next up, Defenders of the Realm, Global Effects cards. It's Global Effects. So some effects are good, some are bad. This is kind of cool to have. I wouldn't say it's essential, but it does really change the game up, and I like to see that. So it's close to being essential. Next up, Defenders of the Realm, the Hero Expansion. This is one of my favorite expansions because it has 4 really cool characters, a thief, a feline, a seeker, and a shaman. Really cool expansion, essential for the game, really opens up different classes. Next up, Hero Expansion number 2. Again, a really good group. You got a druid, a monk, an elf lord, and a healer. Very cool. This is a super team. Just this expansion alone, definitely essential to the game. Finally, their Hero Expansion number 1. This brings in 5 heroes. This is certainly super essential. Paladin, Adventurer, Assassin, Chaos Wizard, and the Captain of the Guard, which gives extra actions to other players. Assassin is my favorite as far as these 5 here, but the Chaos Wizard is very good. Essential for the game. 1 expansion gives you 5 new characters. Also, there is Defenders of the Realm, the Barbarian. Again, a single player card, single miniature in the game. Barbarian is awesome. The Barbarian gets extra attack. Like, they could decide to put their actions in their actual attack. So use your action points to kill things instead of moving around. And finally, Defenders of the Realm, the Dragon expansion. Remember the undead and the orcs and the demons? Well, how about you want to have a board full of dragons? Cool. This gives you dragons. So all the bad guys are dragons. All the minions are different types of, you know, followers of that particular dragon. It makes the game more challenging and difficult, but it's certainly a lot more fun. This is an essential expansion. It adds a couple of other small things as well, but certainly essential for the game. If you play it more than once and twice, highly recommend it. So there you go. Defenders of the Realm is definitely a buy. The expansions are mostly essential or nice to have. There's two left. When I finally track them down, I'll play them out. They came out in about 2000, 2023, so they're more modern for the game. But I love this game. Will I back the expansion? I'm still waiting for the full backer kit to come out, but I will consider it.
That was intense, man. Woo! I don't know. Yeah. I'll never play a third of those, but
I played all of them.
Yeah.
They're awesome.
But now I know which ones to look for.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely want to get the different classes because that's a lot of fun. I'm an old school roleplay gamer, so getting to play those characters that I remember, all those different classes, is a lot of fun. And more and more these days, like if you think about Gloomhaven and everything Gloomhaven has done for the industry, more and more these days attacking bad guys and such are all about flipping cards over. I've played a lot of those games and I've come back to this, and I gotta tell you, there's nothing more satisfying than rolling dice when you have to attack the bad guys. I don't know why, but flipping a little card over to see if you got plus two or whatever it is, is nothing compared to rolling a handful of dice and having to get a high number and hitting that big number. This game's got a handful of dice, man. I love rolling dice to hit things. I mean, it's just, it works. It's so tactile. Flipping cards, I'm sorry. I mean, Gloomhaven's a great game, but it just, No. Can't do it, man. I can't flip a card to do a thing. It just doesn't do a thing.
But there's more strategy.
Sure, I guess. But it's also the same thing over and over, and I don't. I want to roll some dice, man. Roll some dice.
Yeah. I mean, I can't disagree. I like this game as a dice chucker. There is strategy to it because it's got that cooperative element and things move around the map. I would say everything you said about dice applies here, but doesn't apply to almost every other game in this genre.
Sure.
Because I'm not a fan of, like, roll some dice, move a guy around the map. Hey, pick up a card. You found a weapon. Okay, cool. Now roll some more dice. Ah, you hit something with the dice. Yeah. Now roll some more dice. And like, it's like taking D&D and removing all of the interesting story and just moving around on a map and hitting things.
Yeah.
This is not that, which is why I agree with you and I like the game.
Yeah. It utilizes the pandemic mechanic for me in the best way possible. I have not played the super deluxe pandemic with the legacy, but I love the fact and how it's used here. So smart mechanics, old school characters and settings, amazing artwork. I don't know. We'll see what Greater Than Games has when they come out with their version. All right. So that's everything that hit our table this week. Anthony, let's get on to our feature review. Our feature review this week, of course, is all about the top-selling board games of 2023. Anthony's done a deep dive and pulled out a list, and he's going to tell us what's been selling this past year.
Yeah, so it's been an interesting year. I guess 2023 being the interesting year we're talking about. When you went from 2018, right, the two full years before the pandemic, up through 2021, right, one full year into it, the industry grew by 65-70%, according to ICV2. That's a lot, right? Like, it was a straight lineup.
Yeah.
Infinite growth, man. It was happening. We were just, like, living large. But in 2022, it leveled off a little bit, and last year, it almost completely leveled off, right? There was only a 1% increase in growth from 2022 to 2023. Now, of course, if you work for a business with shareholders, that means the sky is falling, it's the end of the world, but it's still a $2.8 billion industry. So I think we're fine. A lot of games were sold.
Yes.
So what we want to look at here is what's driving that, right? Like what went up? And one of the biggest things that went up, ICV2 just reported on this a couple weeks ago, is miniature games, non-collectible miniature games. So this was the strongest category of the year. They said it was up 9% total versus the 1% overall. And a lot of that was driven by like the new edition of Warhammer 40K, which launched with the Leviathan box sometime last summer. Mm-hmm. So Games Workshop, no matter how many people melt down their stuff, keeps making more and more money because they make big products and they make good products. So other games like Battletech, Marvel Crisis Protocol did really well. Star Wars Shatterpoint had a really big launch. So miniature games are still big. People are digging that. The TCG data wasn't really, I couldn't find like a full picture of how it did last year. From what I saw, it seemed like it was kind of a mixed bag, right? You had some leveling off in things like Magic and Pokemon, some of that driven just by like decreased availability. But then you have big launches like One Piece launched at the very end of 2022. Lorcana obviously was huge, but only could have such a dent because they ran out of product repeatedly over and over again. I'll be interested to see how 2023 does for TCGs, because you've got Lorcana running strong. Star Wars sold through 6 months of product in 2 weeks. Magic is Magic. Pokemon coming back with their new stuff. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But we are primarily a board game podcast, so that's what we're here to talk about. And because ICV2 did not publish the top-selling board games of 2023, we are turning to Game Nerds, our favorite online retailer, because they have a list of their 100 best-selling board games and expansions of 2023, which, honestly, I feel is probably pretty indicative of the hobby space, people who know that Game Nerds exists and frequent their website. So, us, right? All right. So, I don't know if we'll read off every single one of these, because I don't know how long that would go or how boring that would be, but we're going to rattle them off, and we'll talk about stuff that kind of jumps out at us as interesting. They have not listed whether these are like top to bottom, what sold the most to what sold the least, or vice versa. It seems like probably this is from most to least, but again, I don't know that, but that's the order we're going to do. So at the top, we have Lost Ruins of Arnak, the Missing Expedition expansion, and the Ark Nova Marine Worlds expansion. I find it fascinating that expansions are on this list at all, because I remember back in the day, they used to only print a few hundred copies of an expansion. They didn't think anybody would buy them. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
It's one of the best expansions. I mean, it was nice to have the other expansion where you got so many different characters. And the asymmetry was excellent. These are the two best characters, in my opinion, having played all of them at this point.
For Arnak,
yeah.
I think so.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then Ark Nova sold 1 billion copies the year before, so of course the expansion's gonna drive that up.
A little bit.
yeah. Earth did very, very well. It was on everybody's best of yet list, except for ours. so, but the only people who are like, meh. But it sold a bunch of copies. And I think part of that for Earth, which is worth talking about, is it's only like $40 or $50.
Mm-hmm.
It's whether you like, it's a fine game. I gave it a play. I don't love it, but $40 is pretty good for this type of experience. Like the same level of game, it's same number of cards, same level of quality, came out in Terraforming Mars 8 years earlier. And it was $70.
Yes.
So this is a good deal.
No, you get your bang for your buck, and it really has more or less stand the test of time at this point.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Ticket to Ride Legacy, one I think we forget about because we're not playing it. these big giant legacy boxes do well for sure.
Yeah, and Ticket to Ride is a family favorite, and the way that the game plays out in small chunks, like we were just talking about with the question of the week, the idea that you can kind of play step, play step, play step, yeah, that works really well.
Yeah. Heat Pedal to the Metal was one of the hottest games of 2022, but was out of print and hard to find. So it's actually still out of stock here now on Game Nerds. So it seems like every time the game comes back in print, they sell them all. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising that it's a bestseller.
I am not a big racing car fan, and I think I gave this a very high play, even maybe close to a buy, just because there's so much in the box and it plays so well with so many different types of gamers.
Right. Yeah. It works well for what it's doing. Mm-hmm. Nucleum. Both played that at the end of the year. Very solid. Great to see a big Euro up on top of the list.
Yeah, and not that expensive either.
No, yeah, Board and Dice does it right.
Yes. We love you guys. Keep the prices where we can afford them.
Yay, sub $50. Great. Touring Machine is a game-ish, more of an experience, but a very cool mathematical puzzle, mm-hmm. for sure. Thunder Road Vendetta is one of those games that I didn't play or even see much last year, and then now it's been on like every best of list for the last 6 months. So I'm like, I guess I should go play this at some point. Not one of those old 80s games I ever played. And so when Restoration brought it back, I'm like, I don't know what this is, but apparently it's great.
Yeah, I've seen it at the Level Up convention. It looks very cool on the table.
Yeah, it does look very cool on the table for sure. Mm-hmm. Cascadia Landmarks, a fine expansion for a wonderful game. Mm-hmm. Glad to see it up here. Sea Salt and Paper, game I know you enjoyed.
Yeah, big fan. It's a small, tiny card game, and it plays really well. It's got great little artwork.
Yeah. Scout was a Spiel nominee, mm-hmm. the previous year. I still haven't gotten a chance to play this one, but I do see it a lot.
You too.
Ark Nova's on the list because it's just on the, you know, it's one of those games.
I mean, I think that's the lasting legacy of Terraforming Mars, is that there's so many different versions and iterations of it, and this is one of two of them.
Right.
Earth and Ark Nova.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. White Castle was, I'm happy that it's so popular, because I love these game designers, but I was surprised that it was so popular because they've designed a bunch of stuff that didn't blow up. But this one did blow up. Mm-hmm. It just won an award, like the American Tabletop Awards, for heavy game. I thought it was fine. Didn't love it. It's very pretty, though. It is very pretty.
I have not played it yet.
So a few more expansions here. We have Unmatched Marvel, Brains and Brawn.
Sure.
So Spider-Man, She-Hulk, and Doctor Strange on there.
Excellent.
For this Unmatched game I still haven't played. Beyond the Sun, Leaders of the New Dawn expansion. Great expansion, but you can't combine the two pieces of it, which is terrible. Hate that. They're both good. Like, let me combine them. But
no,
that's,
you can't.
Game says no. Wingspan Asia expansion. So new stuff for Wingspan.
Yeah.
Always going to be popular.
Absolutely.
Ark Nova Zoo Map expansion. That's a bestseller, apparently.
Sure.
It's only $8, so why not? And then there's another Unmatched on here, Marvel for King and Country. So this one was Bucky, and Black Panther. All right. So some of the other big games, we got Dwarf Romantic, which won the Spiel des Jahres. Mm-hmm. Almost certainly put it up here on the list, because I'm sure people were buying it, but I doubt they were buying it in that volume until it won the award.
Sure.
For Northwood is a great, great little solo trick-taking game. Just such a fun little puzzle of a game. I'm surprised to see it up here, but it's also very inexpensive. It's like $12. So if you even remotely play solo stuff, you would consider it. You should consider it. Sleeping Gods I didn't play this, but I remember you did. Mm-hmm. Like in its entirety, right?
Yeah, we did. A couple times, yeah. In fact. It's a lot of a thing, and it's fine. It's a fine game. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I will leave it that fine game to you. I don't know.
Sure.
Not interested. Star Wars, the deck building game. Great, great two-player game. Not surprised at all to see it up here. It's Star Wars, and it was good.
Yes, very good. Big fan.
Cascadia, the previous year's Spiel winner. Amazing game, one of my favorites.
No, it's a...
Flight?
Yeah, no. Again, not a surprise whatsoever.
Right. Flamecraft. This is another one, like, it's got some surprising depth to it, but it's also really inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a $30 game.
Yeah, they have a deluxe version where you get all the fancy stuff, but you really don't need the fancy stuff. It's a pretty straightforward game and a lot of fun.
Yeah. Eclipse, Second Dawn for the Galaxy. That's cool to see this on here because this is a very expensive game. $150.
And surprise, because Eclipse, I thought got forgotten. Because TI4 was just eating up the landscape. And then they're like, oh, we're going to make a second edition of this. I'm like, will anyone care? It did. They did care.
Yeah. Look, it happened. Yeah, they cared.
We played it. It was good.
Yeah. All right. More Unmatched. So I really got to play Unmatched, man, because it's like it's like half of this list is Unmatched. They're selling it for $400 on Steam or whatever. So we got Marvel Hell's Kitchen with all the Daredevil crew. And then we've got Teen Spirit with like all the young Avengers. There's probably more down this list, but I'm just kind of scrolling down as we go. Resist was on the list. This is the solo game about war resistance that Witchcraft was based on.
Yeah, big fan of this as well.
Yeah. The expansion for Star Wars Outer Rim, Unfinished Business, which apparently made that game good.
Go fig.
Oh, yeah, I didn't like Outer Rim very much. I think I gave it to you, actually.
You did.
So, but everybody's like, Unfinished Business is perfect because it's that Fantasy Flight nonsense of like, here's a game that's fine. Now here's an expansion 2 years later that makes the game great. And I'll never understand that business model because I'm like, well, by the time that game, the expansion comes out, everybody's like, this game's fine.
It's true.
Which is what I did. Meadow Downstream expansion. So Meadow, that very cute Animals in the Woods game.
Very nice.
Ready, Set, Bet. The horse racing betting game.
Sure.
One of a couple. I don't know. It's people love those. I really get it. But, Expeditions, Standard Edition. The Scythe sequel. Bad, y'all. Bad game. Real bad.
Anthony won't let me play it, folks. Sorry.
I sold my copies. I don't have it anymore.
Oh, no. I will never play this now.
Yeah. Someone wanted to give me money for it. I was like, cool, you can have it.
There you go.
Not a fan. All right. Forbidden Jungle, the newish game from Matt Leacock in the Forbidden series.
Sure. Big fan.
Cockroach Poker?
Yeah.
I don't. Why is this on here?
It's been around for a while.
It's an old game. Yeah. It's a fun, weird, stupid game.
Sure.
I almost consider bringing this into my classroom, but I was like, I don't think I need to like encourage the students to cheat and then yell at each other.
Can't imagine why.
That might make some people very uncomfortable. World Wonders was the big hotness for Arcane Wonders over the last year, and it's fine to bad. I don't know. I didn't love it, but I do understand why people are digging it, and it's relatively inexpensive.
Sure.
Lost Ruins, first expansion, Expedition Leaders, still on the hotness, the bestseller list here.
Mm-hmm.
And then Star Wars Outer Rim, the other half with the expansion, of course, also on here. Makes sense. El Grande New Edition, that sold really well.
Yeah, it's always good to see that. It's nice it got a reprint, because...
Yeah. An affordable reprint, too. It's like $35-$40.
Crazy.
Great. Next to Great Western Trail New Zealand, which is not cheap. It's like $60 or $70.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Like, who wants all three versions of Great Western Trail? It's $200 and whatever. Come on, man. we have New Edition of Raw from 25th Century Games. Very pretty cover. I love this cover.
Same.
Forest Shuffle. I never played this because you told me it was mediocre, but I know it sells well.
It's a good game. It overstays its welcome to the point where, like, I love this type of game. I love tableau building. I love this theme. And then at some point, I want it to stop. Dear God, stop. I don't want
No more.
Again, I'm a fan, but I can't. I just, no, stop. I want to get off the ride.
All right, next up, we have two of the top 10 games of all time on Board Game Geeks. Of course, they're here. We have Brass Birmingham and Wingspan.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yep. Splendor Duel was new over the summer. So it's a two-player version of Splendor, which is exactly what it sounds like. So if you like Splendor, two-player game. We have Boop, which is apparently the best-selling version of Boop last year.
This is one I've been saying this, everybody. You got to have the additional O's there.
I use them. It's fine. They have a Christmas version coming out this year, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was some silly pun.
Yes. But
Christmas.
Yeah, it's like It's like a tree kind of comes like three dimensional.
Yeah, yeah. Boo the Halls or something. I don't know. Boop the Halls.
Boop the Halls.
Subterra.
Sure.
I don't know what that is. What is that?
I don't know.
Maybe it was on sale. Maybe they had a bunch of them. They sold. Someone's going to write in like, that game's great. I'm like, okay, good. Evacuation. We played this one a couple months ago. Vladimir Succi's new game. Doing pretty well. Both of the Dune expansions, Dune Imperium and Immortality and Rise of Ix, are on the list.
Sure. Makes sense.
Good stuff. Both of them very good. Unmatched, Cobble and Fog. More Unmatched. There you have it. Hegemony, lead your class to victory. So they presumably sold a bunch of these before they all sold out, because you can't find this game anywhere right now.
It's awesome.
Boop Classic Edition.
Oh, come on, man.
Just
Boop.
Just two O's.
No. God, yeah, extra O's.
Yeah. Like, what are you even doing? What are we even doing here? More O's. Skull.
Sure. Skull's been around Skull forever. Yeah.
Small. Yeah. Good stuff. Yeah. Beer and Bread. You and I played this early last year. Very good little two-player game. One of the only Scott Olms games I like legitimately like.
Same. Love it.
The Furnace expansion, Interbellum, which I don't know if I have it or not, but I never got a chance to play it because I feel like all the energy I had for this game dissipated by the time they finally got the expansion out.
Took a while. I'm hoping that it adds something different to it because it's a good game. It's right. Just I've played its other versions. So right. If this could enliven it, yeah, no, I have the mat for it too. Like I know. I'm just like, too. I'm invested in this. Like, could you just be a little bit better? And maybe the expansion does that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love that. Spirit Island, the big guy.
I've heard of this game.
It's good.
Yeah.
I like this game. Good. Bad Company from Matigo. I'm not familiar with this one.
Nope.
Cat in the Box Deluxe Edition. Just played this recently with you and Will. Yeah. Great game still. Great game. Mm-hmm. Mind Management, or Mind MGMT, the psychic espionage game based on the comic book. Mm-hmm. Unmatched Adventures, Tales to Amaze. So more Unmatched stuff, but this one's like a adventure style game.
Sure.
Stardew Valley, the board game, third printing, sold out.
Jeez.
Whenever that came out. People dig this game, and by all accounts, it's fine, but it's also really long and needs some editing because it's not done by a traditional publisher. Oracalcum from Pandasaurus Games is one of the summer convention releases that I don't think we got to, but that's some decent artwork to
nice.
It. Sky Team, the two-player co-op game. Great stuff.
Sure.
Can't Stop, the classic dice rolling game. In which you
can't stop.
In fact, can't stop.
Yeah.
My Island is the sequel to My City, the Reiner Knizia quote unquote legacy game.
Sure.
Math. A lot of math.
A lot of math.
Dune Imperium Uprising, the standalone sequel to Dune Imperium.
Is it better?
I don't know, man. I don't know. The expansions for the first game sold more than this, so
okay.
Just say, although this came out at the end of the year, so I'm
sure.
Vagrant Song. This was hot for a bit.
Remember? Oh yeah, for quite a bit. It was on sale at one point, like really big for some reason. But people are down for this.
Yeah. Ghost Train. Cool artwork.
It's true.
Unmatched Marvel Redemption Row. So we've got Moon Knight and Luke Cage and Ghost Rider. More Unmatched. Lost Ruins of Arnak. Full game. Good stuff. Great game. All-timer.
Great.
Cloud Age? Why is Cloud Age
on
here?
I have no idea.
Maybe they had a million copies and they've been selling it off for cheap. I don't know.
Yeah.
Marvel Remix, which is Fantasy Realms but Marvel.
I'm down with that.
Fantasy Realms is good enough.
Yeah.
Then why not Marvel?
Sure.
Three Ring Circus is one of the summer games that everybody was buzzing about. In the end, it's fine. So, no surprise.
Yeah.
Wingspan Oceania. Mm-hmm. Oceania? Yeah, you know what I'm trying to
Close
say.
Close enough.
Australia. Wingspan Australia edition.
Yeah.
Is that the second expansion?
It is. No, yeah. It's... So yeah, that you had Europe, and now Australia.
Europe, Australia, then Asia. Right? Mm-hmm. Cool. Kutnahora... The City of Silver, the CGE release. Beautiful artwork on the tiles. I don't think... I actually have this downstairs, but I haven't gotten it to the table fully yet. But I know it looks great.
It, except for the box.
Oh, yeah, the cover's terrible.
But... they did themselves a terrible disservice by doing that.
Yeah, they should go talk to Board and Dice about how they changed their box artwork and suddenly sold a bunch of copies of Barcelona and Nucleum.
Barcelona's awesome.
Yeah, Barcelona's next on the list. So I guess it sold less than Kutnohora, so I don't know. But Barcelona's amazing. And again, those CGE too, like $40 for these amazing deep Euro games. Great stuff.
Sure.
Revive from Aporta. It's kind of a weird sci-fi future-y type thing. I was really excited for this and it ended up not being what I thought it would be. So it's fine. It was a play. Mm-hmm. Deception, Murder in Hong Kong. It's a classic deduction game.
Yeah, I played that recently at Dreamation. And with its expansion, I was like, huh, it really sings a lot better with its expansion. I think it's something, and relatively inexpensive as well.
Yeah, like $30. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Legacy of You is a solo-only game from Shem Phillips about the legacy of you, like an old Chinese myth or legend, mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah.
Great game. Spirit Island Nature Incarnate expansion, their most recent expansion. Just a ton of new stuff in a box. I keep buying these. There's nowhere to put them. two more Unmatched. We have Jurassic Park and then Houdini versus the Genie. So
sure.
More Unmatched. Yeah. It's like half this list, I swear. Kalis 1303, the re-implementation of Kalis. Another one that I think just kind of went on sale.
It's a great game.
Yeah. Isle of Cats, Explore and Draw. Here you go, Chris. This is a game just for you.
No.
It's Isle of Cats.
No, Kalis. Bring Kalis back.
Plus drawing, yes.
No. It's the worst nightmare. No, I don't want to. No.
Grand Austria Hotel. Let's Waltz. The expansion there.
Mm-hmm.
The Exit Advent Calendar for last year. The Silent Storm. These are very cool. The Advent Calendars that they do.
Mm-hmm.
Gizmos. The Simon kind of set it and run it puzzle game. Azul Mini, guess is the best-selling Azul from last year on Game Nerds.
Makes a lot of sense. Not the $300 version that they came out with a couple of years ago?
The $15 version, apparently, is more popular. Cthulhu, Death May Die, still up there. People are digging this older Simon game.
Mm-hmm.
War of the Ring, the card game.
Heard of it.
We like that one.
A little bit.
Mille Fiori.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm down with that.
Yeah. Mage Knight Board Game Ultimate Edition. So this is kind of always up there on the list. All the solo gamers that come into the hobby are like, what's the best one? This one. Okay, I'll buy this one.
Thanks. I got it. Nailed it.
Yeah. Air, Land, and Sea, Spies, Lies, and Supplies. That's hard to say. Why did they do that? I'm not a fan of that.
They were happy with that when they put that together.
There was a lot of backpatting in that meeting.
They're like, yeah, we did it.
We did it, you guys. We're so smart. Some podcaster's going to get stuck on that. It's going to be great. all right. We got two more Unmatched here to get out of the way. Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Sure.
Good stuff. And then Battle of Legends, which I don't even know what that is. I'm assuming just like actual human legends.
Yeah.
Beast. There's a game called Beast.
Yes, there is.
Undaunted Battle of Britain.
Cool.
Undaunted. Surprised more of those aren't on here, but I guess it's kind of slowed down a little bit, those releases.
There's a lot of content in those boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's like six of them now.
Yeah.
Horizons of Spirit Island, which you can get, again, legit, if you want to check out Spirit Island, for $20 online. So if you want to see what Spirit Island's like, Horizons of Spirit Island will give you everything you need for $20. Very low key version of it. But
yeah, play the game. I'd recommend it. I think it works really well. It's smart.
Yeah. Tuscany Essential Edition. Weird, but yes, there it is.
Still here.
Yeah. Not Viticulture, but Tuscany. And then last but not least on the list, Long Shot the Dice Game. Which, another horse racing betting game.
I don't know.
People dig it. So sure. There you go, folks. A completely non-scientific list of the top selling games of 2023 based on maybe what sold best on Game Nerds. We're just going to believe them. but it seems right. Based on what we know was hot last year, this list seems pretty representative of what was big for most people. And I'm not surprised like things like Unmatched are selling millions of copies. They're all IP-based. The game is solid. They're expensive, though, so it's just it's a lot of money for the people out there buying all of those.
Yeah, and a lot of these things are out of stock, so even more so. There's like, these are the most popular games. We do not have these in stock.
No.
All right, everyone. So that's everything for this week. Until next time, this is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And we'll save you all. I'll see you at the table. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.